I didn't sit there and say, I didn't write that book. I didn't get this done. I sat there and said, no, I've got more to do. So, I got more to do. Now, let me go. Let me get at it, you know. I'll raise the GDP of the country just by myself. And, of course, that's not going to happen, you know. Should not be one of lesser and master, inferior or superior. I'm not ready to cash it in by any means, you know.
Hi, friends. I am super excited to talk to you today and to introduce you to someone who's become a mentor to me lately and a close colleague, if you will, in the leadership industry, someone who also has some military experience, but a heavy dose of private sector experience. And I like to think that's one of my value adds. And this gentleman does this in spades for his clients and everyone who's familiar with his work. Mike Etor is a Marine Corps veteran who has C-suite experience in the private sector. Mike is the author of Trust-Based Leadership, Marine Corps Leadership Concepts for Today's Business Leaders. Highly recommend the book. If you are someone who never served in the military, but really values that material and the way in which the military teaches leadership, you're probably here on my program for some of that too. Not that I really codify it the way that Mike does in his book. Maybe one day I'll write a book and do something similar. We'll see. Mike graduated from boot camp in the U.S. Marine Corps, I believe in 1974. That's when he enlisted. And then Mike was an infantry officer and served in some associated units there. He also volunteered for service as a drill instructor in 1976. That's what his bio says. The reality is, having been familiar with the Marine Corps since my Naval Academy days, and since then, I know that becoming a drill instructor is not easy because you need to be selected. You need to be super awesome to be a drill instructor in the Marine Corps. And it sounds like he was the youngest drill instructor in the Marine Corps at the age of 20. Can you believe that? At 20 years old, you're a drill instructor responsible for training recruits who are 18. I think at that time, I can't remember what it is now. You could even be in at 17. Pretty crazy. Mike left active duty for a brief time, went to college, and then got a commission as an officer in the Marine Corps, served in combat operations, was awarded the Bronze Star Medal for Valor with two awards there. Mike was the 1992 recipient of what's called the Leftwich Trophy, and he talks about that in the episode today. Notably, it is given annually to one Marine Corps captain who best exemplifies outstanding leadership within the ground combat arms community. That's a direct quote from the award citation. Pretty amazing. Mike retired after a couple decades in the Marine Corps and joined K-Force, a staffing company. It is publicly traded, started as a director of leadership development. So you can see where his passion is. And then very quickly was promoted to operational responsibilities as a vice president and then ascended to, believe it or not, chief information officer. I'm someone who is in the tech industry in my day job away from leadership. And I tell you, there's a lot to absorb getting into tech. Mike didn't have previous information in IT or any sort of formal education there, yet he became the CIO, did so successfully, and then eventually became the chief services officer there at this large publicly traded company. So served in some crazy awesome and senior capacities, and this has shaped his leadership philosophy along with his Marine Corps experience and training. So plus Mike is just a very real guy. And so I think that a lot of you out here will relate to that. Reminds me of a lot of people around me who I grew up with as a kid, people in my church, in my community. And so I think that will resonate as well. He's super relatable, super fun. I really enjoyed my interview with Mike. Last but not least, Mike and I recorded this episode between two sessions. In the first session, we had a number of technical difficulties, unfortunately, such as life in the digital era. Most of those technical difficulties were on my side, so you will not hear me in the beginning for several minutes. I have pieced together Mike's comments into a sort of monologue. He was telling me at that time about his cancer battle, which he's been very open about on social media. I thought that it was so inspirational and insightful that I couldn't forego it in terms of delivering value to all of you in this episode. He has a very positive, constructive, and realistic approach to this disease, which has touched or will touch all of us in one way or another until we find a complete cure.
If you've been seeing ads on TV or on the web for this Camp Lejeune toxic water, a lawsuit, well, that's me, you know. So I was there in the 70s. 80s and 90s and 70s and 80s, all the way from the 50s on, were evidently filthy. So members of my units have been hit hard. You know, I had my roommate from the early 80s died of brain cancer a few months ago. Went to a urologist. He looked up. I was laying there looking at the TV screen. He said, "You see those two bumps there?" He said, "Those are tumors and not supposed to be there." I'm like, okay. So that started a saga. I had two operations. They took the tumors out, did deep tissue samples. When they went into the second samples, they did not reach the wall, but they found the presence of another cancer that grows on the surface of your bladder. Fortunately, the treatments for both are the same. So I went to Moffitt Cancer Center 6 weeks in a row. They pumped my bladder full of this stuff. I have to hold it for 2 hours. And it's like a tuberculosis live culture. Supposedly it neutralizes cancer and, you know, whatever. So it's a 70% success rate. That said, bladder cancer is so resilient, Sri, that of the 70% this treatment works for, 50% get a reoccurrence within 5 years. So they call it the forever cancer. And so one way or the other, I am going to be a cancer patient for the rest of my life. You know, so I'm like a Petri dish now. The treatments are over. I just let this stuff cook in me until 24 January. I go back to the doctor. He sticks the scope up again. And if he likes what he sees, I'll do another 3 weeks of those treatments. And then I'll just start coming back to him every 90 days for that scope. I'll do that for 3 years. Then after 3 years, I do it twice a year for another two. Then after 5 years, once a year for the rest of my life. And that's assuming that it's clear. And I'm already there, Sri. You know, worst case scenario, this stuff kills me. I don't think that's going to happen. Next worst is I got to piss out of my side for the rest of my life, you know, lose my bladder. And I got to tell you, I don't want that to happen, but I'm already mentally there. You know, like I'm sure you were, We accepted the chances that we would wake up in a hospital in Germany at some point and them saying, "Well, you lost a leg and an eye, but you're alive." Well, that didn't happen to me, fortunately. It's, you know, I'm a teacher, so I want it to be a teaching moment. When you go through something like this, it's a high pucker factor event, you know. I mean, I've been in dangerous situations before like you have, but you have some control, you know. This one, I mean, but the only thing I can control is my diet and my attitude. That's about it. I literally remember thinking, like a smartass, I don't have time for this shit. You know, like I'm vibrant. I got shit to do. And, you know, because you immediately go to the dark side. And then, you know, I allowed myself to mope for a couple days and feel sorry for myself. And then I'm like, hey, it is what it is. Doctors are in your life from this point forward. And rather than treat it like we always do, like a nuisance, like, yeah, just get your shit done. This is not like an outpatient, you know, go there, they fix your molar, and you come back to the dentist, you know, for a yearly checkup. This is not like that. So I came to terms with that, going to be a great patient. And I'm just thrilled that I have a shot to retain my organs. I got a shot, you know. You know, I will say that, you know, and I'm sure you'll understand this from, you know, similar background. In a way, I've been preparing to die for decades, and I'm very big on legacy. And so I want to leave a legacy. So, how you been? Doing okay?
Yeah, I've been good. I'm a little under the weather. So, but I think I'm good enough to fake it here. So, not nothing too bad. I can't complain. I know we were talking in depth about your health situation, but in the first instance of this, before the technical difficulties, how are you doing?
I mean, I feel great. Next big checkup is the 24th of January. So I did 6 rounds of treatments. I think you know that. And then my job right now is to be like a human Petri dish and just let. So something's going on down there. It better be good. You know, that's all I can say. So,
yeah.
So, but other than that, I mean, that's a long answer. The short answer is if I didn't know this was going on, I wouldn't know it was going on. I don't feel anything. I'm working out. I'm strong. I feel nothing, you know?
I love it. Yeah. I love it. That's great. Yeah. That's great. I'm glad you feel that way physically, and I love your positive attitude. So
yeah,
so that's awesome.
One of the few things I can control, you know. So
that's right. Control the controllables.
Going to control the hell out of it. So yes.
What was Mike Etor like as a kid?
Oh, well, that's a great question, Sri. I was born in 1956, Schenectady, New York. Great parents. Grew up, went to Catholic school, and that should be an indicator. So what kind of kid was I? I was a smart kid who could care less about academics. I was from a very disciplined household. My mom was a very strict taskmaster. And, of course, I went to Catholic school, which I got to tell you, the early Catholic school of the 60s, that made Paris Island look like child's play. I mean, they had us falling in formation. There was no talk. I mean, and there was hell to pay physically for anybody that dared deviate from the rules. So that, I think, affected my personality a bit to where I was a bit of a class clown, a hellraiser. I was all throughout high school. I was at the top of my class when it came to those IQ tests they made you take, aptitude tests. But I was always at the bottom of my class academically because, frankly, I just didn't care. You know, I didn't see that. I was always reading, Sri, always reading. I just wasn't reading my class material. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I never got in any trouble, never did drugs, you know, dabbled in alcohol as a high school kid and college kid, like we all do. Most of us do and all that. But generally speaking, I mean, I never got in trouble with the police. But I could be difficult to handle with people in authority because I developed a knack to be able to. I questioned authority. And back then, authority was much different than it was today. When you were a child back then in the 60s and 70s, you were basically owned by any adult. Any adult could stop you and say, hey, what are you guys doing? And you know, you looked at them. Today, you say that to a kid, they're like, F you, and I'm telling my mom, you know, who are you, you know? It was an entirely different situation. So I knew that authority was to be respected, but I also knew that if I had developed a knack for pushing authority right to the line, you know, with my teachers, just questioning them and being a little bit of an ass to them, just to the, if I said one more thing, they'd send me to the office, but I would stop there. And I had developed a knack for it. So I drove my teachers a bit crazy, drove my parents a bit crazy. And then all of that really changed. I was a good kid. All of that really changed when I enlisted in the Marine Corps in 1974. And now I had no choice but to yield to authority. And I was surrounded by authority and good authority, really good leaders and all of that. So that I credit the U.S. Marine Corps with the real, you know, fork in the road that I was happy to take, took it, and it set me up for what I deem to be a fairly successful life from that point forward.
Do you think that questioning authority was a reaction to the nuns, as my mom would refer to the general Catholic education system, or was that just something ingrained in you?
Great question, Sri. I think it's a combination of that, what you just said, and my personality. I mean, why do some kids sit there meekly and other kids decide, no, I'm not going to take this? So there's a couple factors going for me. First, I was, back then, there were not many fat kids, and I was a little fat kid. Remember the movie, yeah, Bad News Bears, fat little catcher? I was a fat catcher, you know? So if you remember the old Leave It to Beaver show, I was a personality and physical mix between Eddie Haskell and Lumpy Rutherford. So I was Eddie Haskell was that smart ass, yeah, always messing with Beav. And Lumpy Rutherford was Lumpy. He was Lumpy, yep, Rutherford, you know? And so that was me. So and back then there was no such thing as bullying and all that. So I got bullied and hazed unmercifully as a little fat kid. And I learned very quickly, I could sit there meekly and absorb it, or I could fight back and resist. And so I was a little fat kid that if somebody, and if I was in second grade and fifth grader or sixth grader was picking on me, I was the fat kid that had a reputation for, okay, I'll fight you. I mean, I'm going to get my ass kicked, but I'll fight you, you know? And that, I think, was a turning point in my life. And that led to me, one of my earliest memories in the Catholic school system was sitting there. There were two things that were burned in my psyche. A girl next to me, I still remember her name, I won't say it. A girl next to me in a desk next to me, we had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. And a lot of times a nun would say, no, you just went, you go this afternoon or whatever. Oh, okay. And the little girl next to me peed her pants. She had a dress on, she peed. And I didn't notice it, but the nun was walking through checking our papers and she said, what did you do? And so the bottom line, this girl had peed herself. And the urine had run off the chair onto the floor, so there was a puddle under her desk. Well, it gets worse. Now that the nun is pointing at her, humiliating, because I think that's the way the nun went to school, and they, I don't know what they were thinking, Sri, the humiliation, yep, part of it, you know, made good Christians. It just did the opposite, I think. But she then said, what did you do? You have no discipline. And then she said, class, look at Susie, not her real name. Look at Susie. Everybody point at her and laugh. And we all knew if you didn't point and laugh, then you were going to be next. So I can remember looking at this girl and putting my hand out and, like, you know, and I knew this isn't right. Of course, she just sat there crying and was devastated. And could you imagine a teacher trying that stuff today? So that kind of stuff happened, unfortunately, fairly routinely. Because I think the nuns back then thought this was good discipline and all that. And it's a dysfunctional family. It was done in the 30s, 20s, 1800s, whatever the case may be. I actually think it probably stopped with my generation or one after it. And then the second thing was when I learned to question or formulate, this isn't right. We're in a Catholic school, we're getting religion classes, and back then, my priests and nuns were very demeaning of other religions. Demeaning, insulting, savages, heathens, you know. And we were getting a religion class, and one little girl raised her hand and said, well, sister, my mom is Protestant. And the nun looked right at her and said, well, she's not going to heaven. And the little girl looked, we all froze up. She goes, well, if she's Protestant, I mean, that's okay, but she's not Catholic, she's never going to heaven. As if the only way to get to heaven, remember now, we're talking 7 years old. So those kind of anecdotes and experiences made me early on to say, instinct, this isn't right. And I think I pushed back to the point a seven-year-old kid pushed back. But those are formative experiences in my life. And I eventually got thrown out of Catholic school in the eighth grade because the priest came and was giving us religion class. And I know this is a long answer, but it's getting to the point was, again, he was talking about other religions and demeaning the American Indians. They have, believe in the fire gods and other religions have statues. And I'm thinking, so I raised my hand. Now he looked at me and he, here we go, this guy, you know. And I said, well, Father, I hear what you're saying about other religions, but we have statues. In our church, we have statues. And we light candles. and we have special masses for someone that is sick. And we use incense and holy water. I said, you know, the other religions could be pointing at us as symbols and customs and stuff. Well, he didn't like that. And then this was the straw that broke the camel's back, Sri. Remember, 13 years old. And I'm like, you know, Father, I think if anyone lives the real tenets of any religion well, I think that's a good thing. I think we're all pretty much the same. And I think if a Hindu or a Muslim or an Indian lives their religion well, I kind of think we all end up at the same place, the same heaven. He did not like that at all. The class stiffened up. He threw me out. I went to the office. They told me to walk home. By the time I got to my house, my dad's car was in the driveway, which meant they had called him home from work. The priest was in my living room, and I got the news that I would be attending public school the next day. So 6 weeks before eighth grade graduation. So, okay. So I went to public school and then, you know, finished out eighth grade, then went to high school and all that. But I never forgot that, you know, and I wouldn't change a thing. You know, I told my parents what I said. Honestly, I had done a lot over the time that where they could have thrown me out. But to be thrown out over that incident, I think, God, that was it. But I think it was death by a thousand cuts, you know. So I don't blame them. I was hard to handle. I was always questioning authority like that. And of course, questioning the dominance of the Catholic religion in a Catholic school. I can't think of a proper analogy for that, but it was, you know, kind of like demeaning the American flag and apple pie. You just don't do some things, you know? So that's it.
Yeah. There's so many aspects of that story that resonate for me. And, one thing I like about, our interactions is that we share a lot of, history in our personal lives. So my mom, being Irish Catholic, her mom was raised by nuns because she was an orphan. So literally raised by the nuns. And I think that, you know, for better or worse, you know, sometimes a mix of the two, the Catholic religion in particular has a formative effect on people. And if I look back at my 7th and 8th grade experience in Catholic school, you are correct. It was not as harsh. We weren't getting wrapped on the knuckles, you know, or anything like that. But I mean, I think all the boys in my class, the prepubescent teens or pubescent teens in my class, all of us, we were like the most rebellious animals you can imagine. And I think like most of that was a reaction to that environment. I mean, you know, teens are going to be that way anyway, to an extent, but I think it was like that. I'm curious, tell us about why you went into the military. What's Mike Etor's origin story as a leader?
So my parents were both in the Army. That's where my mom and dad met. So my parents were both one enlistment folks in the Army. Early 50s, my mom and dad met at Camp Kilmer in New Jersey. I don't think it's there anymore. And so they met and got married. My mom got out, I think, at the two-year mark. My dad, I think, did 3 or 4 years. So after they were married, he did a unaccompanied tour in Germany, post-war Germany. Loved it. Korean War was going on at the time, but he didn't go to the Korean War. Came back, got married, you know, he got married, went over there, came back, and got on with life and all of that. So I was raised like most of my generation, baby boomers, the younger baby boomers. I mean, all of the men, Sri, of that era, just about all of them served in the military. Most of them were in the military during World War II and or Korea, you know. So in my hometown, there was a bunch of guys that had served in the military during World War II, came out, went to school, got on with their life, and got recalled, involuntarily recalled for the Korean War. So there's a bunch of guys that did like 8 years in the military, intended to make it a career. So I was surrounded by those guys, my high school teachers, the men that all served. You know, there was obligated service back then. There was a draft. So, and I, you know, I was the kid in art class when they let you draw. I was always drawing combat scenes and planes strafing the bad guys and all of that. So, you know, Sergeant Fury comic books, you know, back then we, you know, we played war, cowboys and Indians, or Americans versus the Germans and or the Japanese or whatever, you know, it's just what we did. So I think I had a calling for the military. It appealed to me much like a sports team. I was a wrestler, and that sport, individual combat sport, being part of a team, definitely was part of Mike Etor from early on. And I saw the military as that. So I enlisted, you know, I enlisted 5 days out of high school. I was at Parris Island. And loved it right from the start. I knew in boot camp, which is not a pleasant experience, I knew in boot camp I had found a home, that this is where I need to be. And then proceeded to graduate from boot camp. And when I enlisted in 74, Sri, there were still numerous World War II Korean War veterans on active duty. In fact, there were a ton of World War II Korea and Vietnam, three war vets. So, you know, you read a book about Iwo Jima and you find out the first sergeant was there. And so I just idolized those guys. I wanted to be like them when I grew up, and I loved it. And post-Vietnam Marine Corps rank was very fast in the enlisted ranks. And so I was a very, very quickly promoted Marine. And so I led my first squad. I was a squad leader, I want to say at 18, and I was promoted to sergeant meritoriously at 19.
Wow.
So I'm a 19-year-old sergeant, which was really not all that uncommon for someone to make sergeant in 2 or 3 years back then, just the way the rank was. And so I got some leadership experience, and then I wanted to be a drill instructor, a Marine drill instructor, and I applied, my chain of command stuck up for me, and the Marine Corps gave me an age waiver. So I was actually, for a while, I mean, I was the youngest Marine Corps drill instructor. I was 20 years old when I graduated my first platoon as a drill instructor. So I loved it. You know, most of my peers were Vietnam vets. And that was a formative thing on me because I respected their combat experience so much. And then after a while, I realized, you know, I haven't been to Vietnam, and that guy has. He's got three Purple Hearts. But, you know, I'm as good a drill instructor as him. In fact, I might even be a better leader than him. And so that gave me confidence that I could really play. I could compete. And I loved it. So I did that for 2 years and then got out after a single enlistment. Went to college. I wanted to wrestle in college. I did. And I knew that after school, I was either going to be a high school wrestling coach or I was going to go back in the Marine Corps as a commissioned officer. And I chose the commissioned officer route because of the age limitations. You know, I was 22 when I started college, and I only had a year or two to play with on the maximum age for commissioning. So I said, you know, I can always go back and be a coach, but it's now or never to be a Marine officer. So that's what I chose. And I went back in, obviously, and the rest is history. I stayed in until I retired and all of that. And then did get back into wrestling with both of my sons and all of that. And so, you know, checked that box. Loved the sport. Didn't hold much for me. But yeah, early leadership experience, I learned pretty quickly. You know, I wasn't the most gifted athlete. Wasn't the fastest runner. Certainly wasn't the smartest guy. But I learned very quickly that I seemed to have an aptitude for leadership. And that aptitude, if combined with hard work and study and mentorship, which I was, receiving plenty of, I could actually do something as a leader. And so that's my story.
What is something or things that you would change about the Marine Corps? Obviously, it was a home for you. And your coaching and training leadership practice is called Fidelis leadership.
Yeah.
So there's a clear tie there to the Semper Fidelis motto of the U.S. Marine Corps. Yeah. So obviously it resonates. I'm curious, what are the things that were challenges either to you in terms of personal style or in terms of the way leadership and operations and people are done in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, fair question. And I think my answers will resonate with anyone that has any experience in any branch of the military and in any organization that has bureaucracy and rules and history, tradition, and quite frankly, that's the way we've always done things. So I realized very early on that one of the biggest lessons I learned early was the older generations of Marines looking at the young. They called my generation, there was a famous Pepsi commercial back then called the Pepsi Generation. It's the Pepsi, you know, it had a jingle. And so they demeaningly called us the Pepsi Generation. Like, you guys ain't shit, you know. The Vietnam guys told me, look, they said that about me when I came in 1962. And I'm sure the World War II guys came in and the World War I guys, hey, guys aren't, you know. And so that taught me early on that while seniority and experience and history should be respected, the younger generations throughout history have always been demeaned, and somehow they do okay. And so I knew that I loved the Marine Corps and was putting forth as much effort as anyone that ever wore the uniform. And for somebody to just look at me and dismiss me with the flick of a wrist because I was born in 1956 instead of 36, I thought that was wrong. And I never forgot that. And what that has resulted me in, I was the young guy for a while. And then at some point I became the old guy in the Marine Corps. And I loved working with younger generations. Were they raised differently? They were. Did I have to cover some things with them that I didn't need to be taught? Yes. Were they better at some things than I was? Absolutely. So I, as you know, I post a lot on LinkedIn, and I post a Socrates quote anonymously. It's like, this younger generation isn't shit. They're disrespectful. And people say, yeah, yeah. And then I tell them it's from Socrates 2,000 years ago. So they've always been that criticism. So I wish the Marine Corps and all organizations would change that. But I think what I just described, Sri, is human nature. Mm-hmm. I think experienced people, like right now, I'm 66 years old, at the height of my game as far as leadership and passing on lessons. I can get frustrated when somebody that's 22-year-old doesn't appear to listen. And I'm thinking, I'm only trying to help you. Trust me, I've done what you've done, and I failed. I almost got fired or whatever. Don't do it, you know? So I can get frustrated at that. But I got to look back and, you know, I may not have been the most available student at every point in my life when I was young as well. I don't know if the Marine Corps can change that. I don't know if humans can change that. But boy, if they could, you know, embrace the younger generation, leverage their strengths. For example, from what I understand, my knowledge on the conflict in Ukraine is about a thimbleful. But from what I understand, they've got young kids over there who physically are in no way, shape, or form ever going to the front lines. And they're what we would call nerds, you know, technical nerds, the geeks. The kids picked last in gym class. But they have figured out how to use small commercial drones, the ones that you see kids and people in the park playing with. They have figured out how to use them in combat and how to put a hand grenade on them and fly it over a Russian tank and throw it down the turret. And so Zelensky, the president, has made mention of this several times, that we are leveraging our young, smart kids who know these technical things, these electronic systems better than, we don't know how to use them, but they do, and they figured out how to weaponize them. And it's making a difference in warfare. And I think even the U.S. military, all of the cybersecurity and cyber aspects of warfare, I don't see a lot of old guys paving the way there. I see a lot of young cutting edge kids who grew up with technology and then got educated and trained, you know, in it and all of that. Because clearly, as you know, warfare continues to evolve. And if you ignore that cyber domain, you're going to die. And so if you don't want to ignore it, you cannot ignore the younger generation and the newer technologies and all of that.
Absolutely. I don't know if you remember the show Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah.
Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. I know I am. On that note, I have some exciting news. I plan to start coaching a limited number of participants who want to get unstuck, who want to raise their game for their business, their career, their startup, and hopefully improve their impact on the world through greater leadership skills, and someone who can be there one-on-one to sanity check the voices inside their head. If you love the content that I've been producing and you're using it in your work, in your life, then I strongly encourage you to reach out and apply to this program. I currently have a group that I've been mentoring. They're getting a lot out of it, but I'm looking to go one-on-one. And I figure my listeners of The Warrior Poet are the best place to start. So again, limited number of availability slots open. I will have up to 5 people at a time for several months, maybe even longer if we develop that relationship. Most important thing is that you get a lot out of this. So I'm starting here. I'm starting at a heavily discounted price. There will be only 5 slots available. I'm going to keep this super simple. You don't have to go to a website. You don't have to reach out to me on social media. There's no contest here a la YouTubers and something you have to do. Basically, you just need to fill out the Google form that is going to be listed in the notes. Again, super excited to do this one-on-one coaching with you to help you understand and internalize the warrior poet leadership philosophy that I've developed from years in the military, SEAL teams, Naval Academy, things I picked up at Amazon and in tech startups, as well as my MBA at Harvard Business School, which again, as you've listened to this program, you've probably seen me poke some holes in that leadership curriculum. And maybe that tells you a little bit about how my leadership philosophy can help you in your life. So please, please, if you at all think this might be interesting, I encourage you to fill out the form and I will reach back out to you and sincerely hope that we get to talk in real life. Back to the show. I don't know if you remember the show Everybody Loves Raymond with Ray Romano, one of my favorite shows back then. the dad, the grandpa, I think it was supposed to be his wife's dad. Maybe it was his dad, whatever. I remember this one episode clearly where he kept sniffing the baby's head and his exclamation was, "It's like the fountain of youth." and both literally, I have kids, I have nephews and nieces, and there's something about the smell of a baby's head that is invigorating. But in a similar way, what you were saying, that's why I enjoy the tech world. That's why I enjoy startups. That's why I enjoy coaching my kids' soccer teams, is because that energy and enthusiasm, and when people listen, that willingness to learn, that's the most invigorating thing in the world to me, right? So why would I not want that energy? I think people who demean like that, it's just a little bit self-serving, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's age old. It's happened forever. It's happened to you. It's happened to me. You know, as a frogman, I'm sure you ran into the older guys. Oh, it ain't shit. You guys ain't shit anymore. Let me tell you about, you know, it was always harder. Yep. I saw a plaque in a Marine Corps enlisted club one time. Units used to give plaques, and there was a plaque there that was old, and it had the Marine Corps emblem, and written on it was one of those Philippines plaques that people made, you know, and it said, "The Marine Corps isn't what it used to be and never was." And I always I absorbed that. I used to tell guys when I was older and, you know, had a bit of a resume and a reputation, I'd say, "Hey, Mikey Tor is not what it used to be and never was." You know, if you think that I was like this as an 18-year-old Marine or as a brand new lieutenant, no. It's don't believe the hype, essentially. Don't believe our old fitness report system. There was section A, B, C, and D, and section C was the narrative, where your reporting senior would say, "Mikey Tor is the greatest Marine since, you know, Smedley Butler, blah, blah, blah." And we used to tell people, don't believe your section C. Because the way the promotion system was, they had to write about you as if you were Chesty Puller just to get you promoted. But if you read that and found yourself believing it, that was really dangerous. Super dangerous. So don't believe your press releases. Don't believe your Section C. I learned that. You know, it was good lesson. Good lesson.
That's good advice. Tell me about the best leader you ever saw. Who's the leader who, or maybe this is a different question, but hopefully the same example in your life. You know, what leader had the biggest impact on you?
I have to answer that. I can't really single out a certain individual because I was surrounded by so many. What I did have was certain leaders at certain phases of my life that had a profound impact upon me, starting with my dad, 9th grade dropout of high school. He was the youngest of 6 brothers. All 5 were in Europe fighting World War II. His dad was disabled, and so it was up to him to go work and support his mom and dad. So he dropped out of high school, never went back to high school. He eventually did get his GED years later. But all I know about my dad is good guy, hardworking guy, always working 2 or 3 jobs, never complained, supported his family like most fathers do, you know. But by today's standards, probably would have, you know, today, a lot of people whine today. You know, my dad, the term I'll use, my dad didn't have a big screen TV, didn't have a big house, and didn't whine about it. He was happy with what he got, proud of what he achieved. His duty was to raise children, and that's what he did. So my dad was great. My high school wrestling coach, I consider a second father. He took me under his wing, spent 4 years with him. He kept me out of trouble. And then I got into the Marine Corps and was surrounded by father figures. And one in particular was a staff sergeant and then gunnery sergeant named Ross Carter. And I mentioned him in my book, Trust-Based Leadership. I mean, I just idolized 3 tours in Vietnam, wounded in the last month of each tour. So for about 7 or 8 years, his duty stations were Vietnam, Beaufort Naval Hospital, drill field at Paris Island, and then back to Vietnam, where he, in the last month of every tour, boom, he gets shot, wounded, medevac, you know, lucky to be alive. Fingers shot off his hand. Just a grizzled combat vet. And he was my platoon sergeant. And I spent a lot of time with him, talking to him and him mentoring me and all of that. Can't say enough good about him. Surrounded by, as an enlisted Marine, Sri, I led a charmed life. I only ran into what I would call a couple of bad officers and enlisted leaders. The vast majority of them were so good that I remain in contact with them today, that they, you know, I still consider them father figures, mentors. I had a lieutenant that was a foundational, you know, driver in my life. He's the one that said, you know, you're really good. You could be an officer, but you don't have a degree. You got to go to college and all that. So this guy is probably at the time 24, talking to an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, but you know, very much like an older brother, younger brother. So fast forward, you know, several years, I kept in touch with him. He was the best man at my wedding. Fast forward a few years before that, after that, he's a battalion commander and I'm a helicopter raid company commander working for him. So now it's captain and lieutenant colonel. He retired as a major general. And I just talked to him last week and he's in the book as well. You know, the message there was, you don't have to be 58 years old and ancient to be a mentor and a driving force in somebody's life. I just met up with one of my recruits a few weeks ago at a charity event. I was a sponsor, one of the sponsors for a charity event of one of 5 quad amputees from Iraq or Afghanistan that lived. His name is Travis Mills, quite an inspirational guy. And so I was asked, would you donate and sponsor a table? So I did. The woman that asked me to do that is married to a former recruit of mine. So now I go to the event and I see this guy, Paul, for the first time since boot camp. And now we've corresponded. He knows that he was 18 and I was 21. But he met me and introduced me to people. And he said, this is Mike Etor. He was my drill instructor, one of my drill instructors. And he said, no one aside from my father had a greater influence on the direction of my life. That's a pretty heady statement. I'll take it. But my point is, at that point, I was 21, 20, 21. I was just, my mission was to separate the weak and undeserving from the Marine Corps. I didn't really understand that I was having, in some cases, a formulative impact upon how some of these young guys thought and acted for the rest of their life. And he turned out very successful. So I'll humbly accept some of the credit, you know, for that. And so never too young to mentor, never too old to learn from the young guy. And I guess the message is you just never know. One way or the other, we're always mentoring somebody, whether it's by our good example or bad example, you will mentor people.
I do want to get into a lot of the aspects of your philosophy of leadership around things like trust-based leadership, which you mentioned already. But maybe before that, since you've mentioned the impact that your father had on you, this recruit of yours, also mentioning the father, you mentioned the kind of big brother, little brother relationship. And I think you even write in the book around this notion of a paternal relationship between a leader and his or her people. We could maybe extend that to maternal. Can you talk a little bit about that, especially for those who haven't been in the military and had that mentioned before? Because that was mentioned in my Naval Academy training. It may strike people who have only had private sector experience as a little weird or a little too intimate, or maybe the kind of negative connotation of paternalistic. How do you think about that, and why is that the right way, or at least a right way to think about that relationship between a leader and his or her people?
Great question, and I have ready answers for you. If I can, I'm going to hold my book up. So this is the book that Sri is mentioning. This is Trust-Based Leadership. Big book, almost 574 pages. And I wrote this as a textbook for my leadership and coaching engagements. And the reason why I'm holding it is there's a lot of content up here. In the very front, Sri, I explain that the Marine Corps, well, the whole genesis of the book, the whole thesis of it is Marine Corps leadership concepts do in fact apply effectively to the business world. I led civilian businessmen and women exactly like I led Marines. And people are like, what? Because they think Marines are like Rambo and all. It's obviously not true. Aside from boot camp, it's just not true. So early up front, I explained the Marine Corps' philosophy on leadership, which is servant leadership. And where the Marine Corps really got that philosophy imbued into its DNA, we had a famous general back in the early 1900s, the teens, 19-teens, named John A. Lejeune, and he wrote a lot. He commanded an army division in World War I. He was a player, became our commandant. Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, named after him, And he put out a famous statement, I want to say 1923, codifying leadership. And I'm paraphrasing it, but it's up front in the book because the rest of the book is supported by this general feeling, servant leadership, and that the matter, in dealings with enlisted men, the relationship between officers and enlisted should not be one of lesser and master, inferior or superior, rather it should be as father, son, and teacher, scholar. So those statements, the father, son, the teacher, scholar, that this is how I look at young Marines. This is what, it remains true. They read those documents. Every Marine leader reads that statement, and when you look at it, aside from some of the old English and all that, it still applies. You would read it, Sri, and you would say, well, this is Navy leadership. This is exactly what the best leaders in the SEAL teams did. Right, exactly. So he wasn't saying anything unique. What he was saying, I'm the big guy in the Marine Corps, and I'm saying this is how we lead. And then that behavior led into the philosophy. If people ask me, sum up Marine Corps leadership in one line, I would say, okay, leaders eat last. And all that statement implies. Leaders eat last. Well, and people say, what's that? Did you really do that? I said, yes, we really did do that. That whether I was a senior corporal and I was a senior guy in the field, or you have a four-star general in the chow line, the senior guy is the last guy in the chow line. And if the chow runs out, he goes hungry. We take care of the most junior people. And so, yes, when my company lined up in the Saudi Arabian desert waiting for the assault in the Kuwait, and hot chow came on the few occasions we got it, I saw my Marines joking because they were joking, you know, the PFCs were, how many months in grade do you have? You know, they were making a joke out of it, but the lineal precedence of that company was in that chow line. And of course, I was the very last guy. So I and my first sergeant, we would go all the way to the front and watch the Marines come through. And sometimes we'd be the one handing out chow and all of that, but it was very clear to them, we don't take a bite, not a drink of that food until everyone less senior to me, you know, junior to me, eats and all of that. I find when I relate teacher, scholar, father, son, in that context and that those examples, civilian businessmen love it. They just love it. A, they've been exposed to it and they remember how good it was, or B, they've not been exposed to it, and C, they realize whether I've seen it or not, I can do this. And I'm telling you, I have been places where we've taught people, and I have had CEOs tell me, no, Mike, you go, I'm senior to you. You go first. You go through the executive, you know, the boardroom lunch buffet that we've got. I'm the last guy. And so it's much more than eating last. It's just everything that it implies.
Tell us about trust-based leadership. There was a particularly, it resonates a lot, perhaps because of our shared military experience. But I will say there was one company I was at, which I won't mention the name, where it was a particularly distasteful experience. There were a lot of politics and a lot of micromanagement, a lot of manipulation, passive aggressiveness, things that are just not part of my ethos and just personally don't enjoy being in an environment like that. There was a gentleman who had arrived just before me. I will mention the company he was at. He was at IBM. It was a senior person that I looked up to, and we shared a kind of this relationship as the new guy, even though he was several levels above me. And I remember one time him summing it up in a larger meeting where we were expressing the things that we believed needed to be fixed. And he summed it up as, there's a lack of a trust model here. Hey gang, quick note here. I've moved a ton of my efforts in terms of content creation to LinkedIn. So if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, please do. I've been posting a lot there. I've gotten a lot of great feedback. Feel free to stalk my profile and check out a lot of the old posts. Most of them should be evergreen. I very rarely comment on today's news. Of course, there's a lot of layoffs going on now, so some of my content over the last few days before recording this program were dedicated to that. Hopefully some of that actually is helpful if you find yourself in that situation. But my content is by no means limited to that. I post on the same sorts of topics I post on here. Leadership topics, as well as things about business, things about really just getting out of your own head, right? And trying to achieve the goals that you want to achieve in your life, but can't seem to sometimes, or maybe aren't doing so fast enough, or maybe just aren't finding fulfilling. There's a lot of things that we can do, practical tools that we can apply in our own life. I try and share them here, but for the stuff that doesn't go into this, because a podcast is a lot of work. I'm not sure if the word's gotten out. I love it. That's why I do it. I do it because it's hopefully providing value to you, but I can't put everything into a podcast. So I do that generally on LinkedIn now. I'm also on Medium. I'm also on Instagram, those sorts of things. But LinkedIn is where I'm at right now. So please follow me. My full name is Andrew Sridhar. That is S as in Sam, R-I, D as in David, H-A-R. That's how my dad used to spell it all the time on the landline phone growing up. And even though I go by Sri, you will find me under both those monikers on LinkedIn. So hope to see you there. Enjoy the rest of the program. Which was such an interesting phrasing that I hadn't heard before, and it just has stuck with me many years later. So I'm curious how you think about trust-based leadership and maybe how you've seen that applied well in your private sector experiences.
Yes. Thank you for that, Sri. I will say, and I tell, you know, I talk to a lot of transitioning Marines and other veterans coming out. And I've been there. And sometimes we look down in the civilian world like, these guys don't know what they're doing. You know, let us get out. Let me go. Let me get at it. You know, I'll raise the GDP of the country just by myself. And of course, that's not going to happen, you know. And so I tell people, no, I've met civilians who've had no formal training that would have been great Marines. So I think you agree with that. We see some people, but largely, I find that most businessmen, most leaders in corporate America have received no training whatsoever. So what I tell them, they often ask me a similar question, set of questions you're asking. And I tell them, okay, in Mike Etor's world, a leader first and foremost has to have impeccable character. It has to be the character and all it implies, character and integrity. That's the only zero defects mentality that I personally have operated under and that I love and that I teach. Character is what you do when nobody's watching. It's the ability for you to have moral courage in the face of groupthink and all of that. So character is one thing. And then, of course, integrity. I simply will not lie and will not support a lie, you know, passively or actively. I won't do it. Then after that, I tell them as a leader, the phrase I use is your job is to lead by example in all that you say and do. And colloquially, I'll say your job is to show others what right looks like. And people say, oh, that's pretty neat. Yes, your job is to show people what right looks like. Character, integrity, competence in your job, behavior under stress, because there's going to be some people are looking at you in a stressful environment. And if you just lose your stuff and go crazy, you're teaching. Whether you realize it or not, you're teaching. And so that's my whole emphasis is character, integrity, only things that are non-negotiable. Everything after that, it's all leadership by example. And then followed up with, I have something, I post this quite frequently. It's one of my more liked and shared posts, Sri. I talk about the leadership epiphany. What I call the leadership epiphany. And it's best for leaders to have earlier vice later. And the leadership epiphany is that day that a leader knows that he doesn't have to, he's not expected to be the smartest person in the room. He's not the smartest person in the room, that he's got a lot of other smart people around him. And saying things like, I don't know, and what do you recommend? Are not only not seen as signs of weakness, they're seen as signs of strength. And that leads into what I call the three big questions. The leader paid attention to everything I just said. I say this is the key to being a successful leader. You're in charge of a team, a department, IBM. I say that the solutions to almost all of your problems a resident in your company. Someone knows what to fix. And if you ask these three questions, what should we start doing? What should we stop doing? And what should we do differently? Now, if you've listened to what I just said above that, if you have created a culture of trust where you trust people and people trust you, and they are willing to speak truth to power. When you ask them, what should we stop, start, or do differently, they are going to give you answers that you're going to be like, he's right. You don't need to spend a lot of money on consultants in most cases. The guy on the shipping dock knows where the inefficiencies are. If you'll get me a new forklift instead of the one that's 25 years old, I'll be able to lift 10 pallets at a time instead of three. And this old one goes 3 miles an hour. The new one goes 10 miles an hour. You get my point, you know? And so but it all goes back to character and integrity, which is the foundation of trust, which is why I named my book and my model the trust-based leadership model. You can be the smartest guy. You've got a great business degree. You can go to your business school. You can be all the pedigrees in the world. But if you don't trust people, and you, in fact, have not developed a culture of trust, all is lost. Mediocre results at best. At best, you'll never wring out maximum value unless you can get maximum trust in a 360-degree environment. That's my thought. That's my key towards, you know, thoughts.
I love it. I love it. So let's dig into that. And if that were the only other thing we talked about, I think it would be totally worth it, right? Like how do we engender trust in companies, organizations, NGOs, whatever, you know, families, et cetera. And I will say, Mike, I'm going to have to stop earlier than our time block because I have to hop on a plane. So, but if we spend the rest of the time on this, that's great. So walk us maybe through an example or examples of where a leader had a real tough time trusting other people. Because I've seen this story many times. I have, in some cases, succeeded in increasing trust in that organization and with that leader, specifically with his or her peers, manager, and directs. But in some cases, it's a very hard problem. And in some cases, it appears, even though I think we all believe in growth mindset now, sometimes it appears that that person is just stuck in their ways, and it's going to be really hard to teach an old dog new tricks, right? So, and sometimes there's ego at play, all that sort of stuff. Like, how do you increase trust in a person who their whole life, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, they have had a tough time doing that, and the culture of the organization is such that that is reflective of that distrust?
Good question. One that I think applies situationally to both the military and the business world. I used to tell Marines, for every bad officer who had zero trust in their NCOs and staff NCOs, I will show you an officer that's now a major or lieutenant colonel that as a young lieutenant was absolutely burned by an NCO or staff NCO. Because all officers are taught at Quantico, trust your NCOs, they'll steer you right. So they come out like virgins, ready to trust these guys. And unfortunately, there's a small percentage that take advantage of that naivete, and they leave the lieutenant with his ass hanging out. And he says, never again. And then he becomes that guy that's a micromanager, clearly doesn't trust. I mean, I've heard officers say, I simply don't trust staff NCOs. I think that they're devious and they'll, you know, any you know, ends justify the means and all that. I'm like, whoa, that guy is burned for life, you know. I've seen that in the business world as well, where someone got burned early on by a boss that lied to him or her, or they were the boss and everything's going well. And the day before a go live, a technical rollout, the program manager quits and just sends an email. Hey, I resign effective immediately. We're doing an ERP implementation tomorrow. And so those things can cause people to become jaded. So there's two ways to attack it, Sri. If you're senior, you got to trust people. Let's say you do. You've listened to all I've said. Okay. But you know you got people below you that have come from different backgrounds. I think you have to mentor as a group and say, here's how my organization is going to run, and here's how I need you guys to run. I know you've all grown up differently. You may have been burned in the past. But I prefer that we approach people We assume good intentions. We assume everybody's trustworthy. We recognize that there's varying experience levels and that we cannot abrogate our responsibility to supervise. So if we do have that one rogue or renegade out there, if we supervise, have reports and all of that, we'll probably catch aberrant behavior quickly. If I'm the junior guy, and I've been in this position, and my boss is a non-truster, I would sit him down and say, look, Joe, I did this. Look, Joe, not his real Joe, I've worked for you for, you know, X amount of years or months now. I've worked in this company X amount of years. I've got a reputation for getting results and all of that. I can just tell you, you're asking me the level of questions and putting a level of supervision on me that implies you don't trust me. Nothing I've ever done shows that you should do that. You're wasting your time and mine. I'm asking you to contemplate this and let me report to you once a week instead of you coming in at random times during every day asking me what the status of the project is. If you'll just trust that I'm going to, and so he did that and changed in his 50s, late 50s, because he'd been burned in the past. And you know, in the publicly traded world that you're aware of, Sri, there's no trust from Wall Street to a publicly traded company. Mm-hmm. When a publicly traded company says, these are our results for Q2, before they can publish them, they are obligated by law and SEC regulations to bring in a third-party auditor to say, yes, we've looked at this. Yes, they're telling the truth on earnings per share. So the whole system is set up not to trust and assume that corporate America is lying, because unfortunately that's happened in the past. And so I do think what you're hitting on, the trust, the cultivation and the maintenance of trust is so important, yet it is so foreign to some people that it takes a dedicated effort on the trusters to have that good contagion going around and for the non-trusters to be willing to stop the infection that they're spreading around. Because you know, you've been there, Sri. If you know that for no good reason, someone simply doesn't trust you, at some point you're like, you just find yourself doing what's required. And I mean, because a guy that doesn't trust is also typically a poor leader who doesn't recognize someone going the extra mile. So it's kind of like, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't trust my people. Therefore, they know that. And human nature and stuff will like, okay, the guy has no regard for me. He wants 5 pounds of work. I'll give him 5 pounds. Now I see 7, 8, and 9 pounds over there that need to get done. I'm not doing it. I know this is going to be an issue 3 weeks from now. Well, let's let it surface 3 weeks from now. So only in a culture of trust do people have that ability to speak to power, truth to power, and answer those three big questions honestly. And if you trust people and they can trust speaking to you, like I said, I think almost all of your problems in most companies can be found in the smart people within the org structure, not necessarily in leadership roles either.
Yeah, yeah. I think that a lot of times, in addition to being burned, sometimes it boils down to the character of those individuals. I would sum it up as the root causes being fear, selfishness, and lack of ownership, especially amongst people who are middle managers who don't trust. I think it's those three things, and maybe they've been burned, but sometimes I think it's just, their mindset, their character dating back way to childhood and the way they carry themselves. So I think I think your tips there in terms of how to evolve the organization and increase that trust are powerful. And it's nice to know that 50 something year old executive was able to do it. So if he or she can, then perhaps anyone can.
It was amazing. And you're exactly right. I think a lot of it was his childhood and all that. And then this guy had gone, to a good school, legit MBA, legit publicly accounting experience. I mean, this guy was a real businessman, but he had been burned and told me, Mike, and once we got to trust each other, he told me, Mike, in the past, I was working in big banking, mergers and acquisitions. And on several occasions, I've literally had peers conspire against me and exclude me out of deals. They stole millions of dollars from me. And then I realized very quickly, it's every man for himself. And I have to assume that they're lying to me and trying to screw me. I was like, and he goes, you wouldn't do well in that environment, Mike. And I'm like, you're right. I don't want to work in an environment where I have to assume my colleagues are out to screw me out of money or in any way trying to dog me or make me feel bad. And so I didn't want to work in that environment, high finance environment and all that. But because he had been burned, he brought that baggage with him. And he did come around, but only by continuous great performance. To where he was a skeptic. You know, like, all right, I hear you. It's on you. And then after a while, I think he realized they're onto something here. And yeah. We were off to the races. And he became nothing but a champion and an obstacle remover and an enabler for us. And I admired that, changing doctrine, so to speak, at that late age. Hard to do. And he did it, which showed his worth as an executive. He was adaptable.
Yeah.
He had to prove it to him. But he was adaptable.
So, that's great. Something else that you said earlier really stuck out to me, which is in your analogy of seeing, you know, I think you said 5 pounds and you see 6, 7, 8, 9 pounds and you may not go after that and let it manifest in a few weeks or something like that. It really stuck out to me because I think what's not appreciated is that in a distrustful environment, regardless of how that's caused and who's to blame, everyone can be suboptimized. Even the best among us are human and will not do our best in that environment. And then people like this executive you mentioned in your example, they may produce results in spite of that lack of trust, not because of it. So that's a super big lesson for me here.
Yeah, I agree with that. In fact, and how I'll amplify that is in the book. We got to trust people. All the book is pie in the sky. Got to trust people. They won't let you down and all of that. And I tell them, you want to have people take initiative. That's the whole Marine Corps maneuver warfare initiative, strategic corporal, do what's right. You know, frogmen. The commander's not always there. It thrive on team leaders, small petty officers making decisions that could be in the nightly news that night. Mm-hmm. And they do it well, you know?
Yep.
And I tell people, you talk all that stuff, and then you, God help you, if you utter what I call the 6 words of destruction. Somebody makes a decision. You want them to make a decision. They make a decision. You're the CEO or an executive, and a department head, 2 or 3 levels below you, makes a decision. Here's the 6 words of destruction. Who told you to do that? The minute you utter those words to somebody, who told you to do that? The whole organization realizes, okay, Mike he's been on initiative forever. This guy took initiative. Yes, it didn't work out all that well. And now it's who told you to do that? From that point forward, they'll never take initiative again. They will do what they are told, and no more and no less. And so you'll stifle all hopes of initiative. And an organization without initiative throughout it is mediocre at best. Usually worse, but mediocre at best. And what I tell people is, instead of the 6 words of destruction, somebody does something. Even something boneheaded, even something that gets you as a leader the wrong, you know, there's 2 kinds of famous, good famous and bad famous. Well, we've all been the bad kind of famous where we had to go see the master chief or the commander or the CEO, like, tell me about this, you know, what the hell? Instead of saying, who told you to do that? It's like, okay, well, Sally, obviously this didn't work out right. Appreciate the initiative. Tell me, what was your thought processes? Why did you do what you did? Walk me through your thought process. And, you know, the assumption is nobody's going to do something wrong on purpose. Nobody wants to get the wrong kind of famous. So Sally will say, well, A happened. I did B thinking that C would happen. But D happened. I didn't really think of it. So then it's like, okay, first, I use the first aid analogy. First, let's stem the bleeding. So let's fix the bleeding right now. And then secondly, let's talk tomorrow. And I want you to come back and say, look, now with what you've learned, what would you do differently? Because clearly we can't do that again. So let's stem the bleeding and repair what we can. And then let's talk about what would you do differently? And then when you figure this out, we're going to teach it to everybody else. And then as a leader, I would say, look, Sally did this, but I got to be honest with you. Faced with the same situation, I would have done the same thing. And the results would have been the same as Sally's. Not good. And all of you probably would have done this. So Sally took the hit. But thank you, Sally, for being honest. And so you end up taking a bad situation and making a teaching moment out of it. But you don't ask those questions. Who told you to do that, Sally? She took initiative. It didn't work out well. If you want others to take initiative, and you do, you have to be very gentle and deliberate about how you treat people in that situation. Otherwise, I ain't doing anything, you know?
I love it. And I'm sure that Sally, in this case, would be very appreciative of that interaction after that bad kind of famous situation, and that situation would really stick with her and probably everybody else from that yeah. teachable moment. So I think that's a super empowering message that despite when things go bad, we can turn them around and really make great leaders and instill that initiative. So I think
as you know, Sri, it's one of the defining aspects of a leader. It's how I think you guys have a saying, it, everyone wants to be a frogman on Friday. Is it,
you know, sunny day.
The weekend's coming
sunny
up.
Day. Yeah, on a sunny day.
Everyone wants to be on a sunny day.
Yeah.
But I guess when it's raining and you're up to your ass in foul smelling mud, a little bit tough, you know. And so everyone wants to be a leader. And being a leader is fun when everything's going great. You're making good money. Everybody loves you. Everybody, blah, blah. You're peeling back the veneer and seeing what really Mike Etor is made of. It's when things aren't going, because that's when character reveals itself. And the term you've heard before that I apply is don't shoot the messenger. Because if you shoot the messenger, future messengers will not come to you.
Yep.
They will not. And, you know, bad news doesn't get better with age. If you shoot the messenger, your bad news in the future will come to you very aged. And a problem that could have been easily fixed as a 5-pound problem this week, they're not going to come to you. And lo and behold, 3 weeks from now, it's a 500-pound problem. Now you have some serious problems because they were afraid to approach you with a stubbed toe. And now you've got arterial bleeding. And so in that aspect, leaders, it's karma. You will reap what you sow relative to trust and initiative and willingness to speak truth to the power.
Well, Mike, I think that's a fantastic place to wrap up. I could pick your brain for another few hours here, but I think you've left the Warrior Poet audience with a ton to chew on. So I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Sri. I read your posts. I love what you're doing. I'll talk about leadership all day. As you can see, I'm passionate about it. I got spit on my computer screen. I just love it. So I'll come back anytime, and I respectfully ask that you come on my podcast so I can pick your brain in return.
Deal.
Don't let go, nail down, too many days.
Brainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Sri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Sri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Sri.
No, Kevin. Me na do it. Spita.